So, yes, I would like to speak about sort of other type of problem in Ramsey theory, which we now know is about to find certain configurations in large subsets, a very structured set like the set of natural numbers. But one of the earliest results were about partition of nice sets like the set of natural numbers. Or in other words, so what they were looking for, if one partitions the natural numbers into finitely many parts, that at least one of the parts contains a certain given configuration. And indeed, one of the first results due to Schur, which I think was in the 20s, but I'm not, in the 16th, so in the time. So his study is... I see, yeah. So I wasn't sure about that. And, I will make a couple of more... I wasn't sure about Schur, and among other things. So his study will come... will be a problem probably later as well. So anyway, what he proved is that suppose you take the first n integers, positive integers, and you color them by k colors, which is the same thing as partition them into k classes. And then if this n is large enough with respect to the number of colors, then this simple equation x plus y equals z has a solution, x, y, and z, such that each of them has the same color, what we will refer to as a monochromatic solution. So Schur himself wasn't, I think, originally interested in any coloring problem. He was interested in a much more famous problem, and that was Fermat's last equation, x to the k plus y to the k equals z to the k. And as often number theories do, if you have a Diophantine equation and you want to see if it has a solution or not, first one looks at the solution mod p. So whether there is a solution mod p of this equation for every prime. And Schur proved that if the prime is, say, large enough with respect to the degree, then indeed there is always a solution, and it's non-trivial in the sense that none of them, x, y, or z, none of them is divisible by p. And maybe surprisingly at first, this almost immediately follows from the above-mentioned coloring result. And so if anybody, of course, knows this, then... but So the idea is simply that if we take the field of congruent classes mod p and the multiplicative subgroup obtained by removing zero, then the set of k powers form a subgroup. And the index of this subgroup is at most k, because x to the k equal 1 cannot have more solutions than k. So one can color each coset of the k-th powers by one color, and if p is large enough, then there is a monochromatic solution. But how a monochromatic solution looks like, it looks like that each element has to be from the same group, and the sum of the first two has to be equal to the third one, and that just gives us a solution of Fermat's last equation mod p. So this only showed that this equation is hard, because for nice equation, if there are nice solutions, mod p for every prime, then often there is a so-called global solution, solution in Z, and this is exactly the opposite of what was going on here. So maybe the first person who systematically looked at coloring problems for linear equations was Rado, who may have learned about this from Schur. So what he looked at is, one takes a linear expression, a1x1 plus asxs, and look at the homogeneous equation, sum of AIXI equals 0, and ask the question, is it true that if I k color the first n integers, then there is a monochromatic solution of this equation? And under what conditions on the coefficients this is true for every finite coloring? And if this is true, then the equation is a so-called partition regular equation. So there are solutions in every finite partition. And he found a necessary and sufficient condition, and that condition was that there is a subset of the coefficients which adds up to zero. That necessary and sufficient condition for a linear homogeneous equation to be partition regular. Now, so all these results are expressed in sort of finite ways. So once the number of coloring is given and the equation is given, one can ask how far do we have to go, how large n has to be, such that if we k color the first n integers, then there is a monochromatic solution. And in the case, although this is just a simple linear equation, maybe it has many variables, the bounds, except in special cases, are very bad. They are recursive in the number of colors. In most cases, that means that if you increase k by 1, that you have to increase the bound exponentially. So this is in contrast to the case when the sum of all the coefficients equal to 0. For example, if you take the equation x plus y minus 2 z equals 0, then the sum of the coefficients, all the coefficients is 0. Solutions of that equation are just three-term arithmetic progressions, and the first proof for that already gives a much better bound, which was exponential, not power type in k. And the main difference between these two types of questions is that in this special case, the sum of coefficients are all 0, then the solutions are translation, the equation is translation invariant, so if x, y, z is a solution, and you translate each of them by the same amount, it's still a solution. And that's really much used in the different approaches to these problems. So when the equation is not translation invariant, then in general it is harder, seems to be harder to approach it either with a Fourier analysis or with some other methods to get good bounds. So, for example, a more quantitative version of Rado's theorem came much later, at least the combinatorial proof came much later, due to Graham, Rödl, and Schacht, and it was in the late 80s. So again, we consider a partition regular equation, but now we want to count how many monochromatic solutions are of the equation sum of AI XI equals 0. And they proved that positive proportions of all the solutions of the equation, if you have s variables and each coordinate, each xi is between 1 and n, then one can have all together n to the s minus 1 solutions, and the positive proportion of them is monochromatic of the solution. So in some sense, this is a very strong result. And the proof of this was combinatorial, and I only mention this result because I will need that. I will need this result for later. Now, so what I will consider are sort of inhomogeneous equations, and an example of that, which is very much related to what the previous two talks was mentioned, the theorem of Sarkozy and Fürstenberg, sort of a coloring version of that, a non-translation invariant coloring version of that is the following problem. So again, suppose that the first n integers are k colored, and suppose that n is sufficiently large with respect to k, then there exists two number x and y of the same color, but which they are different, such that sum is a perfect square. So as opposed to Sharkey's theorem, it's here not the difference, but the sum is a perfect square. And this was proved, I mean, this at least appeared quite recently, by was done by Semeridi and his former student Hofala. And it sort of verified, it was conjectured by some combinatorists earlier. And what may be interesting about this result is that, as far as I know, it does not have a combinatorial or an ergodic proof, maybe because no ergodic theorist really looked at this problem. But the only proof given is Fourier analytic. What I want to talk about is an analog of this problem, but which is about nonlinear equations. So the polynomials involved are a degree higher than one. So more precisely, just to describe the type of problem I want to talk about is that consider an expression Lx, sum of ai xi square. And I will assume that the corresponding linear equation, sum of ai xi, is partition regular, so a subset of the coefficients add up to zero. So actually I answered already half of the question, under what conditions, at least, although it may not be necessary that L is a partition regular equation. And then we consider an integral polynomial, and we look at the equation sum of ai xi squared equals p of z, and sort of we try to establish conditions on the polynomial p such that this equation is partition regular in the weaker sense, that the xi's are monochromatic. So in other words, we want to find xi's of the same color such that the left-hand side, this expression, will be equal to some value of a given integral polynomial p. In this case, No. I don't assume that, because then it would be translation invariant, and then actually Matthew Smith has a very nice and direct proof that actually then you don't need coloring, then you can just take one set of positive density. And so here the point is that it is, so that we don't assume that. Okay. So this sort of consider sort of a starting result of this type, because I don't at all have necessary and sufficient conditions on the polynomial P for this to be true. So I have some sufficient conditions. One is that the equation sum of ai xi square equals p has sort of trivial solutions. So I have solutions when x1 equals x as all the same numbers, so then it reduces to the equation a times v square equals some value of p, and I will assume that there are infinitely many pairs u and v, such that this is true. This could be one sufficient condition, and this can be relaxed to some so-called local conditions about where you assume sort of solutions just mod q for each q, but I will assume for this talk the stronger conditions, because then the arguments are technically much simpler. So maybe at some point I should mention some result. So let K and S be positive integers and at some point we will use a mean value theorem which forces the number of variables f to be quite large, although that maybe can be reduced, but not all the way down. So we will assume s bigger or equal than 9, and then we will consider the equation I talked about, and I assume that the sum of the coefficients ai adds up to 0 and p satisfies that condition. And what I try to prove, not just that there exist solutions, but there exist many solutions, many monochromatic solutions for any given k coloring. I don't quite get the exact best number of the monochromatic solutions, but clearly I lose a power of n at some point because I have to impose an additional linear equation in the process. But of course this shows if n is large, we have of course non-trivial solutions. These are much more numbers than when possible choices when all the x are equal to each other. So one way to look at this equation is that we would look at just Rado's equation, but instead of the xi's, instead of the numbers, the squares of them are colored. So if you're sort of looking at just the squares are colored, then the left-hand side becomes a linear equation. So the proof, so one reason I looked at this problem because sort of the proof seemed to be maybe interesting. Yeah, so I just mentioned here that, for example, if you take a monomial of odd degree, that satisfies that condition among many other examples. And also to see how much we are off from the total possible number of solutions without asking they are monochromatic, we are up with the power of n, because a quadratic equation reduces the number of variables by 2. So that's why we have n to the s minus 2, and this n to the 2 over d, how many z we can have if the degree of p is d, such that p of z is at most n squared, so that the left and the right hand side are the same order of magnitude. So in this proof, there is no induction or no induction on the number of colors, so there is no density increment argument. So it's somehow more direct than that. So first of all, there is sort of a reduction modulo a very composite number. So it's somewhat similar to what sometimes numbers here do with Diophantine equations. So in other words, since we only require the xi to be colored, we can just choose, we can try to find solutions, monochromatic solutions, from a fixed congruence class with respect to some fixed modulus. So we're looking at the xi in the form some q times xi plus v, and then we can also find the z from the right-hand side with respect to some from a fixed congruence class from some other modulus. In this case, the choice will be q squared. So if we just plug these choices into the original equations and we look for the different powers of q which appear on both sides and compare them, then, for example, so if we plug this back into this equation, our choices, then, for example, the terms which doesn't involve q will be the equation will be exactly our condition that a times v squared equals p of u. So that's one thing we require for these two choices u and v. And then on the right hand side there won't be a term whose coefficient is divisible by q. But on the left-hand side, there will be a term, so that we impose simply an extra condition that sum is zero, and then we look at the rest of the terms. On the left-hand side, that would be a q squared, and if we divide everything with q squared, we would get the right-hand side a polynomial of this type. Now, the main thing about this polynomial, that every coefficient is divisible by very composite number except the linear term, and that's really what we will exploit. That really will make everything much simpler. one can reach, and since we assume that there are infinitely many pairs, u and v, which solves this equation, then we can guarantee a choice such that the coefficient of z is non-zero as well, so we can scale with that. We can further scale x, I, and z, and we can make this coefficient to be 1. So on the right-hand side, we will get the following type of polynomial. So choosing the right, we can choose u and v such that we now want to solve a pair of equations. First one is just the homogeneous Rados equation, and the second one is a quadratic equation. But the main thing is that the polynomial on the right-hand side has a linear term, just z, and all the other coefficients are divisible by a q. And this q will be choose to be a very composite number. It will be the least common multiple of all numbers up to a certain threshold, k. Okay. So for this equation, we don't need coloring anymore in the following sense. We will choose a color class such that by this theorem, so this is Graham, Rödl, and Strachmann, the generalized Riemann hypothesis. So by this theorem, we can choose a color class in which the linear equation has roughly as many solutions as possible. And we fix that. And then we will just show that the second equation is solvable within that fixed set. Let's denote this set by A. So basically we are just looking for a solution in a given set of this type of equation. And of course, once someone fixes a set, then one can write down the number of solutions analytically. For each equation, one defines a corresponding exponential sum, multiply them together. So in the exponent, we get our equations back. In the exponent involving alpha, we have this equation. Involving beta, we have that equation. So when we integrate in alpha and beta and sum over x i's in A, then we exactly count the number of solutions. So we have this kind of analytic expression, which tells us how many solutions do we have in this set. So here is where we use the fact that all coefficients of the polynomial of the right-hand side, except the linear one, is divisible by q. That will force us that the exponential sum with that polynomial in the exponent multiplied with this parameter beta will be concentrated just around zero very strongly. What happens, this is a little bit different than the usual thing, because usually an exponential sum is concentrated along rationals with small denominators, but at near every other rational with small denominator, the main term will be vanish because the higher coefficient divisible by q. So I don't want to go over that's very standard major minor decompositions. One uses Dirichlet principle to approximate every beta with a rational of denominator q such that it's very close to it, and then one can basically distinguish two cases, whether the denominator is bigger than a power of n or smaller. If it's bigger, it's so-called beta is in a so-called minor arc, and then one automatically has a non-trivial estimate, decay estimate on beta. And in the other case, since we are very close to rational with a small denominator, basically the exponential sum decomposes into a product of a sum mod q times an integral. And this sum is the exact analog of our original sum, but the summation is just from y equals 1 to q, and beta is replaced by the rational b over q. And if q is small, then it divides all coefficients of the polynomial except the linear term. So basically, it is just that exponential sum which adds up to zero, unless q equal 1. So that's why the only case when we don't get an estimate is near zero. If q doesn't divide our choice then the denominator has to be somewhat large, and one can use just a general exponential, some estimate u to hua, to get a decay. So that's sort of the exponential sum estimate. And actually, in the proof, essentially just one more trick is required. That's, I call a translation trick. And that's how the original argument of Semeridi went, to improve Rho's bound on three-term arithmetic progressions. So the idea is, somehow, that we relax the equation. So we had these two equations, but now we include an extra parameter W, and we look at the solutions of these equations in when the first x1, x all are in A, but we have two more variables, W and Z. So if we fix W, then we look at the xi where this expression takes the value not in the image set of the polynomial P, but the translate of it. And if we take all these translations, we get as many solutions as we want. So on the other hand, we will see as long as W is not extremely large, it doesn't matter how we fix W, we get always the same number of solutions as we would get when W equals zero. So these two things together forces that the number of solutions has to be large. And indeed, this is not at all hard to work out. So we fix the W. Now that those two letters are M, and MW denotes number of solutions of this sort of this new equation, M, the original equation, and all what happens on the Fourier transform side, so to speak, is that we get a factor, because when we take the exponential, we get an extra factor e to the 2 pi I w times beta, and we subtract 1 from that. But the only place where the function g is not small enough is when beta is very small, so that forces that w times beta is small, so this expression, e to the 2 pi w beta minus 1, is actually small, so what forces that the product of these two terms is always small. And then basically one just do an analog of Poincaré's theorem to estimate. So one takes a uniform estimate for these two terms, and the remaining product, one just use an analog of Poincaré's theorem, which comes to a mean value theorem, because the product, for example, that's the point where we need that S is actually at least 8, is that the product is always less. So we take a product of 8 terms, for the rest of them one does just a trivial estimate, and the product of 8 terms is less than the sum of the 8th power of each term. But if we integrate the 8th power of each of these function fi, that's a very well-known quantity. If you just write it back in the ordinary space, that is nothing else than the number of solutions in A of these pairs of very well-known equations, for which is known that one loses 3 degrees of freedom, so we get n to the 5. So putting all this together, what one gets, that no matter how we choose W, as long as it is less than n1 square minus some constant, we always get the same number of solutions. So, on the other hand, when we add them up, then it is easy to see that we get as many solutions as possible, in a sense, because first of all, we have a lot of solutions by this theorem for the linear equations, and for each solution of the linear equation, we fix the values xi, and we just look at how many values of the polynomial p of z is in an interval of a fixed length. And if this interval is long enough, then in these intervals, the values are regularly distributed, so we get the right proportion of each value. So when we add up all these solutions, then the solutions for all these W's, we get the right number. So blowing in a direction. So, writing this down, a total number of solutions. So the first term comes from number of solutions of the linear equation. The second term, N2, is just the number of range of the variable z, such that p of z is in the same range as the left-hand side, so it's an appropriate power of n to the 2 over d, essentially. And this extra term comes from the fact that we look at the proportion of the numbers of z which fall into a given interval of length, and that interval, the ratio of this interval to the whole interval, the possible values, is some small negative power of n1. So this is because we restrict the range by this factor. So if n denotes the number of solutions of the original equation, and we know that m minus mw is always small, then basically the left-hand side is nothing else than the number of possible values of w times the number of solutions of our original equation, plus an error, but that error we can make as small as we want, actually smaller than this constant appearing on the right-hand side, which comes from this theorem of those three mathematicians I mentioned a couple of times. So that basically tells us that the number of solutions are large. So there are a lot of non-trivial solutions. So in fact, it also tells us that there are solutions when at most two of the x's agree. And actually, one can modify the argument to show that there are solutions and all of them are different, but monochromatic. So this I consider sort of a starting result of these types. Of course, the natural question would be, what about higher degree equations? So what is the problem, if any, to generalize these two equations when we don't just sum the squares, but we sum, say, some fixed powers, sum of x1 ai xi to the d. So that would be but there is a problem, at least at the moment, with that, because in the solution we use this theorem that the linear equation has many solutions. So what we would need to show that, for example, if we look at the quadratic version of Rado's single equation theorem, that is, we look at this equation, sum of ai xi squared equals 0, then we can somehow still establish that a positive proportion of the solutions are monochromatic. And this proportion just depends on the coefficients and the number of colors. So actually, one can prove that this equation also has monochromatic solutions. And actually, one can also prove it essentially with combinatorics using van der Werden theorem, or one can sort of modify the proof of Ross theorem to get a different proof. But none of these two proofs gives the right number of monochromatic solutions. So that is one question which sort of one obstacle to consider this partition regularity of higher degree equations. And honestly, the condition, although it sort of naturally came up in the proof, that there is a subset of the coefficients which adds up to zero, may not be necessary in this problem. So for example, a natural question would be just to look at the equation, sum of the squares of S numbers, monochromatic S numbers, whether it takes the value of a given polynomial. And the question would be, for what polynomial this is true, for any coloring. So that would be another question which I believe should be true for a large class of polynomial P of Z. So, but somehow one has to modify this reduction process in the beginning to treat those equations. So So basically, in general, it's a more general question, how can one use Fourier analysis for sort of to treat coloring problems? Because even with the original Rados equation, there is not a good Fourier analytic approach which would give better than a tower type bound. Although on the other hand, for translation invariant equations, which are much more singular, like a K-term arithmetic progression, there are Fourier analytic proofs which even can handle that much, much more difficult case. So, thank you very much. The last one. Now I already shuffled them, but it was very quick. Oh, it's here. This one?
This one.
Sum of x I squared equal to
z.
Could be, yes.
Do you have any, for example, for small, very small s, you should have some counterexample. Do you have anything?
I haven't. Well, I don't even know when s is bigger than 5 in the first place. But this is.
For s equal 5, I think there is some logic.
Well, if x equal, that is, when x equal 5, then the left-hand side is very regularly distributed.
Right.
So that's So
it would be good to have counterexamples for smaller than 5s.
Yes. Well, of course, it could depend on the right-hand side, what polynomial. So, for example, you take like a monomial on the right-hand side, some power of z, and then yeah, for s less than 4, probably should be.
Should be
wrong. Yeah. Because, I mean, you can take a very sparse values of a large power, so, yeah.
Any other questions?